And Radio Derb is on the air. This is your immaculately genial host, John Derbyshire, striding forward fearlessly into our 21st year on the internet. Greetings. Monday this week was June 3rd, a significant birth date. Yes, it was on June 3rd, 1808, that Jefferson Davis was born. 53 years later, he became President and Commander-in-Chief of the Confederate States. Davis was an honest and intelligent man. He carried out the duties of his office with fair competence. When the Confederacy was defeated, he was imprisoned for 2 years by the Union government and then released on bail. Then, after a few months, officially pardoned by President Andrew Johnson. In those days, even the most intense, most bitter sectarian feelings were tempered by ideals of chivalry, honour and justice. Today, Davis would have been tortured and then burned alive on the White House lawn, while a mob of college-educated lesbians screeched their approval. We were a different country in 1868. In some ways, better than today. In some ways, worse. Speaking as a reactionary pessimist, I am mostly going to emphasise the better. But for sanity's sake, let's try to keep the worse in mind too. That remark I just made, of course, applies generally, not just to 1868. It applies to 1944, for example. That year has been in the news because yesterday, Thursday, was the 80th anniversary of D-Day, otherwise known as the Battle of Normandy, when tens of thousands of Allied troops attacked German-occupied Europe with amphibious landings and airborne assaults. So the news media have been showing us touching pictures of grizzled old veterans paying their respects to fallen comrades in the Great War cemeteries, or being thanked and congratulated by notables like William, Prince of Wales, who are nearly 60 years their junior. One of my favourite reminiscences of D-Day is a 3-minute clip that the late Andy Rooney recorded for 60 Minutes 20 years ago. Here you go.
Because it was part of my life, I'd like to say something about D-Day. I don't know how to say it any differently than I did in a book I wrote called My War. If you are young and not really clear what D-Day was, let me tell you, it was a day unlike any other. There have only been a handful of days since the beginning of time on which the direction the world was taking has been changed for the better in one 24-hour period by an act of man. June 6, 1944 was one of them. What the Americans, the British, and the Canadians were trying to do was get back a whole continent that had been taken from its rightful owners by Adolf Hitler's German army. It was one of the most monumentally unselfish things one group of people ever did for another. We all have days of our lives that stand out from the blur of days that have gone by, and the day I came ashore on Utah Beach, 4 days after the initial invasion, is one of mine. As we approached the French coast, there were small clouds of smoke and sudden eruptions as German artillery blindly lobbed shells over the hills behind the beach. They were hoping to hit U.S. troops or some of the massive amount of equipment piled up on the shore there. Row on row of dead American soldiers were laid out on the beach just above the high tide mark where it turned into weedy clumps of grass. They were covered with olive drab blankets, just their feet sticking out at the bottom, their GI boots sticking out. I remember their boots, all the same on boys, all so different. No one can tell the whole story of D-Day because no one knows it. Each of the 60,000 men who waded ashore that day knew a little part of the story too well. To them, the landing looked like a catastrophe. Each knew a friend shot through the throat, shot through a knee. Each knew names of five hanging dead on the barbed wire in the water 20 yards offshore. Three who lay unattended on the stony beach as the blood drained from holes in their bodies. They saw whole tank crews drowned when the tanks rumbled off the ramps of their landing craft and dropped into 20 feet of water. There were heroes here no one will ever know because they're dead. The heroism of others is known only to themselves. Across the channel, in Allied headquarters in England, the war directors, remote from the details of death, were exultant. They saw no blood, no dead, no dying. From the statistician's point of view, the invasion was a success. Statisticians were right. They always are. That's the damn thing about it. On each visit to the beaches over the years, I've wept. It's impossible to keep back the tears as you look across the rows of markers and think of the boys under them who died that day. Even if you didn't know anyone who died, your heart knows something that your brain does not. You weep. If you think the world is selfish and rotten, go to the cemetery at Colville-sur-Mer, overlooking Omaha Beach. See what one group of men did for another on D-Day, June 6, 1944.
That was Andy Rooney, who died 12 years ago at the age of 92. I recall Rooney vaguely from the quirky little clips he used to do for the 60 Minutes program. There were things not to like about him, and he sometimes rubbed me the wrong way. But he was a fine war correspondent and a close observer of life. That D-Day clip is a little classic. 80 years on from D-Day, how does it look in retrospect? The first thing to be said is the thing Rooney said. Admiration and respect for the thousands of young men who fought, suffered and died in what they believed to be a righteous cause. But then, 80 years is a long time. Long enough for revisionists and conspiracists to burrow away underneath the narrative of righteousness and glory to tell us that it was all lies. It was all sordid and corrupt. Don't you know that World War II was a scheme cooked up by international bankers with Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt as their paid hirelings? Or willing stooges, or dim-witted accomplices, depending on the borrower? That Pearl Harbor was staged by FDR to give us a pretext for going to war with Germany? That General Patton said we'd fought the wrong enemy? That the boys who died storming the Normandy beaches were dupes and suckers? And so on. If that's your kind of thing, there's plenty of it on the internet. Dig in. For myself, I am strongly predisposed to believe that most things are as they seem to be, that the common historical narrative is most likely the true one, and that conspiracy theorising is one of the minor forms of mental disorder. Indeed, there are doubts and ambiguities that can fairly be raised about World War II. Yes, we fought in alliance with Stalin's USSR, a state even more brutally totalitarian and much bigger than Hitler's little empire. No, it's not clear that a Europe under German domination would be any threat to the USA, Hitler's foolish declaration of war against us notwithstanding. You don't need to be a conspiracy bug to ponder these things. As I started out by saying, though, the past is another country, in some respects better than the present. And when we look back on D-Day from 80 years on, it's as Andy Rooney said, Your heart knows something that your brain does not. The courage, idealism, and fighting spirit of the 1944 USA, and its sheer ability to plan, organize, and successfully carry out a colossal operation like Overlord, and then, 25 years later, land men on the moon, those qualities, those abilities shine dazzling bright against the impotent bickering and squalid compromises that characterize our public life today. Sure, much has been gained, but much too, perhaps more, has been lost. All that said, there is a negative gloss you can put on D-Day that I think is worth airing. Next segment. A lot of people have been posting on social media that if the heroes of D-Day had been able to see what would happen to their countries, mainly the USA, Britain and Canada, they would not have fought. Here's a post at X that I've just been looking at. An old black and white photograph of Allied troops going into battle with, superimposed on it, a thought balloon coming out of one soldier's head saying, "I hope my grandchildren become minorities in their own country." There is documentary support for that bitter sarcasm, at least in the UK. Back in 2006, British author Nicholas Pringle published an appeal in the local newspapers of his country asking for men and women who'd fought or served in World War II to offer their memories and their opinions as to whether all the sacrifices had been worthwhile. Pringle got enough responses to publish them as a book of over 500 pages, titled The Unknown Warriors, which you can buy on Amazon. The vlogger, who calls himself Zoomer Historian, has posted a one-hour YouTube video about Pringle's book under the heading, "Do British Veterans Regret Fighting World War II?" Pringle's respondents were Brits and a few Australians and New Zealanders in their 80s and 90s. So, of course, you have to discount those responses some for the natural and universal tendency of geezers to think that the past was better than the present, without altogether discarding the truth I started out with, that in some respects, the past was better than the present. Even discounting for ordinary geezer grumbling, though, Pringle's respondents were remarkably negative. Here is the voice of Zoomer Historian talking about Pringle's book. This starts at 51 minutes 13 seconds into the YouTube clip. The title of the clip, once again, "Do British Veterans Regret Fighting World War II?"
This video could have gone on for hours, but since the sentiments of all the responses tended to be much the same, I thought I'd spare you the trouble. Instead, I settled for writing down the general trends, and I also made a tally of positive and negative responses. Bear in mind, I went into this video expecting a rather even split. There were 182 responses in total. Of those, 30 seemed to be a little confused on the assignment and just gave a recount of their war experiences and didn't touch on how Britain has changed. 3. Yes, that's right, only 3 of the responses in the entire 500-page book were positive. All 3 have been quoted above, and all 3 were positive due to personal financial success. So naturally, that leaves the rest, meaning there were 149 negative responses. The numbers speak for themselves. As for the trends, here is what I noticed. I will simply read them out and let you make your own conclusions. Firstly, immigration was by far the biggest complaint. Almost every response mentioned it. Of these immigrants, it was mostly Muslims and also blacks from the Caribbean who were viewed the most negatively. Not one person referred to immigration positively.
That's a British perspective, but it maps pretty well into what I hear from American vets and see on social media. It also calls to mind some of the problems and paradoxes of immigration control. Pringle's respondents are World War II vets, which means they are geezers. Hindsight is proverbially 2020. Those vets and geezer-adjacent Brits and Americans, like your genial host, who can clearly remember their nations as they were 60 or 70 years ago, we understand the blessings of demographic stability better than do younger citizens who grew up hearing authority figures tell them it was wicked to think about such things. And then there's the issue of why, when the immigration catastrophe got underway, which in Britain was during the 1960s, in the USA somewhat later, why didn't that senior generation, who were working adults and voters at the time, why didn't they vote to stop it? We are democracies, aren't we? The fact that it was a catastrophe with dire consequences for the nation's future was already plain back then. For those who didn't see it, the great British politician Enoch Powell gave his fellow countrymen a warning as loud and eloquent as it could possibly be in 1968, to widespread applause. And yet, the demographic destabilization went on from strength to strength. How could that be in a country under representative government? Why didn't citizens vote to stop it? I have pondered that at length many times here at Radio Derb. And that too maps into the present-day US situation. Even setting aside legal immigration, which badly needs addressing, uncontrolled mass illegal immigration is causing dramatic, expensive, unwanted changes in our national life. Yet the politicians allowing it to happen, even encouraging it, are polling decently well. Current voting intentions for the presidential election in November show 44% of voters favouring Joe Biden, who has thrown our borders wide open. On immigration, only 41% of us want the numbers decreased. 26%, that's better than one in four, want the numbers increased. Does a quarter of the US population really dislike their country, its character, its history, and their fellow citizens that much? I guess so. Two weeks ago, I gave you notice that elections to the European Parliament were coming up, June 6th to 9th, and that, quote from myself, prospects look good for immigration restrictionist parties, end quote. Well, here we are at June 7th, with those elections underway. It's a five-year cycle. The last elections were in 2019. The votes get counted on Sunday. Allowing for the difference in time zones, we here in the States will probably know by around 7 p.m. on that day, Sunday the 9th, what the new parliament will look like. The Euro Parliament has limited powers. It can't legislate for member nations. It can only approve or veto legislation proposed by the executive, the European Commission. It can make a major nuisance of itself to the EU bureaucracy, though, and the preferences of European voters, as revealed in these 5 yearly elections, echo back into the politics of member countries. Seats in the parliament are apportioned by each country's population, so the big fish are the most populous countries. The biggest five, each of them with more than 50 seats in the current 705-seat total, the biggest five are Germany, France, Italy, Spain and Poland. They all have strong populist conservative parties, although only Italy has one actually in power. That is the Brothers of Italy party, led by Giorgia Meloni, known as Giorgia Pipolina to Radio Derb listeners. It's a curious thing that if you look up the table of nations of the world listed by total fertility rate, the last three of those nations, Italy, Spain and Poland, clump together, although in reverse order, near the bottom. Of the 227 nations listed, Poland is number 217, Spain 218, Italy 219. The actual fertility rates there are down in the 1.3s and 1.2s children per woman. France and Germany score higher, numbers 121 and 190 in the rankings, with fertility rates 1.9 and 1.6. Why does this matter? Well, a politician whose nation is down at the 1.3 or 1.2 level, like Italy, Spain and Poland, should be worried about it. If the politician is comparatively young, as politicians go, he or she should be seriously worried about it, foreseeing major population decline in his or her own lifetime. Giorgia Meloni is only 47, so those remarks apply to her. Hence her immigration policy, which has brought her some criticism from the sterner kind of immigration restrictionists. She's pretty stalwart on illegal immigration, that is the Mediterranean boat people, but she wants to encourage legal immigration. I would guess, although I don't know, that some similar considerations are in play for the leaders of Spain and Portugal. France and Germany, not so much. And the populist conservative parties of those nations, Marine Le Pen's RN party and the AfD party in Germany, can take a stronger line. So the populist conservative bloc in the European Parliament has some tensions, the more so since the bloc expelled Germany's AfD party 2 weeks ago after some unfortunate remarks by its lead candidate. We shall find out on Sunday how it has all played out with Euro voters. Britain is, of course, no longer in the EU, thanks largely to the efforts of Nigel Farage, whose UK Independence Party led the Brexit campaign to victory in a referendum 8 years ago, this June 23rd. Farage has mostly stayed out of politics since then, until this week, when on Sunday he announced that he'd be standing as a candidate in Britain's July 4th general election. As I have been reporting, legacy conservatism has been dying a slow death over there, just as it has over here. The legacy conservative seat warmers over there, the equivalent of our own GOP, are the Conservative Party, which, during 14 years in power, has conserved nothing at all. The opposition Labour Party doesn't inspire much enthusiasm, but British voters are so frustrated by the uselessness of the Conservative Party, especially its failure to stand up against the Great Replacement, that the polls predict a Labour Party landslide, even though the Labour Party itself is more or less open borders, with a big Muslim voting bloc. A new party called Reform UK was founded 5 years ago, advertising itself as traditionalist and anti-woke. It hasn't gained much traction, mainly because of lacklustre leadership and low levels of funding. But then, in Sunday's announcement, Nigel Farage said he would stand as a candidate for the Reform Party, and if elected Member of Parliament, he would lead that party in the House of Commons. That caused a minor political earthquake. It's highly unlikely that Reform will win the July 4th election, but with Farage on the ticket, Reform will draw votes away from the Conservative Party, making the humiliation of the Conservatives even worse. With any luck, it might kill off the Conservative Party altogether, a fate the party richly deserves. So, fun and games in elections across the pond, Euro and British. Who knows? Perhaps strong populist successes over there will encourage more Americans to tick the box for Donald Trump in November. With the establishment rigging the vote counting 9 ways to Sunday, it may not help, but who knows? And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. The trouble with being an opinionator is you're supposed to have an opinion about everything. A strong opinion that you will vigorously defend. There I'm at a disadvantage. There are whole zones of the human world in which I'm not sufficiently interested to have an opinion. Example, the COVID pandemic, its origin, the vaccines, Dr. Fauci. I said as much as I could think of to say here at Radio Derb in the February 28th, 2020 podcast when it was all new news. I haven't commented much since, other than with an occasional roundup of the social and political consequences of COVID hysteria. For example, in my March 27th podcast that same year, 2020. Our collective addiction to hysterias and moral panics is kind of interesting, but there are so many of them that commentary gets tiring. Is Dr. Fauci a distinguished immunologist and conscientious public servant, or is he a limb of Satan? Sorry, no idea. He's been in the news this week, I'm not sure why. It all makes me feel like a time traveller from an earlier era, which I guess in a way I am. When I was a child, parents worried obsessively about childhood diseases. Mumps, whooping cough, diphtheria, chickenpox, polio. We all knew what an iron lung was. A neighbour child ended up in one. When there was news of a new vaccine, everyone took it. The fundamental attitude I grew up with was fatalistic. If that virus has got your number on it, it'll get you. Meanwhile, enjoy life. So the huge fuss over COVID, the lockdowns and the closures, struck me as weird. It didn't affect me directly, though, except in that my wife was assigned to work from home, which she still does, and which I rather like. So, sorry, no opinion. Item. The most enduring, most heated of our moral panics is the one about race. A phenomenon that, of course, does not exist, except as a figment of your imagination. There's gold in them thar hills, though. When a moral panic is at its loudest and most heated, those favoured by luck or talent to take advantage of it for self-promotion can make a fortune. So it was with Ibram X. Kendi. He was teaching history at a private college in Washington, D.C. in mid-2020, when the nationwide frenzy over the death of street hoodlum George Floyd erupted. A few months earlier, Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, had come out. It had received friendly reviews in progressive outlets, and it was selling decently well. Kendi was in exactly the right place at the right time. As the George Floyd rapture took off, so did his book sales. He was famous, being interviewed all over. Boston University gave him an endowed chair and the space and the resources to open a Center for Anti-Racist Research that, by mid-2023, boasted 45 employees. He was showered with money, most famously $10 million from Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter. Last Sunday's New York Times magazine reported at length that the Center for Anti-Racist Research has been an almighty flop. In spite of $55 million worth of funding across 3.5 years. Last September, Kendi laid off more than half its staff. When the Times reporter went there to interview Kendi in December, she found the place, quote, mostly empty, end quote. There doesn't seem to have been any financial hanky-panky. Boston U did an audit, and Kendi came out clean. It was just that managing a big academic enterprise like that, with dozens of employees, was beyond Kendi's abilities. As our own Steve Saylor observed, with supporting data, Kendi just isn't very intelligent. I started out by saying that those favoured by luck or talent to take advantage of a moral panic for self-promotion can make a fortune. I think my or should have been an and. You need luck and talent. Kendi had a major stroke of good luck, but no talent. Item. In my May diary here at Vidéo.com, I lamented the sorry state of book production, describing a gross production error from Wise House Classics, which is a very respectable book publisher. Then on Tuesday this week, I opened my morning copy of the New York Post to find that its production had been fouled up. A newspaper is produced as a single long sheet of printed pages, which, in the final stages of the production process, is sliced up into separate pieces, each one 2 pages wide. Each piece carries 4 pages on its 2 sides, 2 from the low-numbered pages, 2 from the high-numbered. So if your newspaper has 40 pages, the first piece has pages 1 and 2 on its left-hand half, pages 39 and 40 on its right. The next piece has pages 3 and 4 at the left and 37 and 38 at the right, and so on, until you get the piece with the newspaper's middle 4 pages. Pages 19 and 20 at left, 21 and 22 at the right. These pieces are stacked. The stack is folded down the middle, and there's your newspaper, with the pages all in order. Well, the one I was looking at over my breakfast oatmeal had not been properly cut. Some of the pieces were too wide, containing fragments of text that belonged on other pieces. Even the folding down the middle had been buggered up. The fold went down through text. When I grumbled to my kids about this, they rolled their eyes. Do I not know how prehistoric I am, getting an actual paper newspaper delivered every morning, and living in a house full of printed books? Everything's online nowadays. Hello? This is what it's like to be mentally yoked to a dying technology. In this case, the technology of printed words on paper. This is what it was like to drive a horse and buggy in an American city around 1925. This is what it was like for tribesmen armed with spears and swords to charging Queen Victoria's soldiers when, whatever happens, we have got the Maxim gun, and they have not. I tell you, it's not easy being a reactionary. Item, and this is Pride Month. I cherish one of Steve Saylor's best quips, that when kids growing up in the 21st century see the title of the old Gary Cooper movie, Pride of the Yankees, they probably come away assuming that Lou Gehrig was a homosexual. That aside, this being Pride Month gives me the opportunity to renew my plea that everyone should please stop trying to say unpronounceable abominations like LGBTQIA2S++ or whatever the hell it is this week, and just refer to the persons concerned as Prouds. It's short. It's just one snappy syllable. You can't elongate it or mess around with it. And it's hard even for the easily offended to take offence at it. Please join me in this, people. Say it out loud. Say it proud. They are the Prouds. Item. And just one more word about Nigel Farage. The word is English. As in, could the guy be any more English? It even seems wrong to call him a guy. Nigel isn't a guy, he's a bloke. A true English normie. Even his name is as English as it could be. Was there ever, since the War of Independence, was there ever an American male child christened Nigel? Nigel is as English as Basil. As it happens, my dog, the Hound of the Derbyshires, is named Basil. I've had to train my neighbours to say Basil, not Basil. Other than one or two Fawlty Towers fans and an old movies buff, They only know the herb. And yes, I know, Farage was educated at a private school and his dad was a stockbroker. Those things don't necessarily detract from being a bloke in the English class system, which has subtleties that outsiders cannot fathom. Farage anyway makes up for his upper middle class background by drinking draft ale in pints and smoking fags. That's all I have, ladies and gents. Thank you for your time and attention, and thank you for your continuing support of VDare.com and Radio Derb. Country music fans of the senior demographic will know that as well as being a birth date, June 3rd is also a death date. The deceased here was Billy Joe McAllister, who jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge for reasons connected somehow, we are not told precisely how, with the first-person female narrator of the song. In this case, Bobby Gentry. Rest in peace, Billy Joe. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
Was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today, Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. And Papa said to Mama as he passed around the black-eyed peas, well, Billy Joe never had a lick of sense. Pass the biscuits, please. There's 5 more acres in the lower 40 I got to plow. And Mama said it was a shame about Billy Joe anyhow.